Hello and welcome to the Inside Dish on Lehigh Valley Art Salon, where we explore the culinary arts in and around the greater Lehigh Valley. I'm Mike Drabenstadt, your host for the culinary tour of our region and its amazing food scene. I'm here with Vika Sparber from the Black Forest Deli in West Bethlehem. Vika, welcome to the Inside Dish.
Thank you very much.
Now, the name Black Forest Deli might be confusing to some people. They think the Black Forest in southern Germany, but you certainly don't make German food, right?
We do not. We actually, when we took over the business about 11 years ago, it was a little grocery store over the years. So we just decided to keep the name. But if I had to go back and do it all over again, I probably would rename the business.
But now when people think
too late now.
When people think Black Forest Deli now, they think of good food to start, but they also think of Russian and Ukrainian
yep.
food, which is your nationality, correct?
Yep. We are originally from Kiev, Ukraine. So we started off more as a deli in the beginning of the business, but then we tried to put our authentic food into the menu. So we are mostly now selling borscht, pierogies, halushki, halupkis. Nobody really comes for a sandwich anymore, even though we still have those.
So if you want a sandwich, you can get one, but why would you?
Yeah, sandwich is a sandwich. Our sandwiches are good. I created the whole menu from scratch. So I made like custom gourmet sandwiches, but you can get a sandwich. We have a lot of great local delis in the Lehigh Valley where you can really go for a good sandwich. But if you do come to our place, I recommend and I will suggest if you do come in, I'll probably change your mind if you're going to go with a sandwich or something. I say, no way, you're not getting that. So get a bowl of borscht or something.
Now, you mentioned borscht, you mentioned halupki, halushki. What are some of the maybe atypical Russian dishes that you might make that people maybe aren't as familiar with?
We do a lot of stuff with the cabbage and beets. So beet salad is pretty popular. Our pierogies, like I said, is something that we win awards every single year, probably like 6 years in a row. We won like best pierogies in the Lehigh Valley now. So a lot of different things. The best way to taste whatever we have on the menu is probably come to our five-course Kiev dinner, where you would actually get a tasting of everything that we make, and we make much more than what we have on the menu for those dinners.
I think last time I came to the Kiev dinner, I got to try 15 different I wasn't counting, but it must have been 15 or 20.
Just for the first course. There's four more courses after.
And those, I think the Kiev dinner is one of the just most amazing culinary experiences in the Valley, because you just keep bringing different types of food out. So even the first course, which is appetizer and salad, there are things that I've never seen or heard of before, even though everything's really fresh and accessible. Tell me about some of those dishes that you might bring out.
So we are very big on zakuski, which are, we call those appetizers. Kind of, it's more of a, for us, dinners are more of a social thing. We don't go to eat and done in 15 minutes and then we're doing something else. If you go to a typical authentic Russian-Ukrainian restaurant in New York or Brooklyn or Philadelphia even, where the Russian-Ukrainian population lives, you will notice that the dinners are almost like weddings. You come in for, let's say, 8 p.m. reservation, and you're there until 2 or 3 p.m. 2 or 3 a.m., I mean. This is like a 4-6 hour thing where there's a show included. People just keep eating, keep drinking. It's more of a social thing. That's why we kind of took that idea and brought it to our Kiev dinners, where you come in at 6 o'clock and you're there most likely until 9 or 9:30 p.m. So it's more of an event rather than just you come in, we kick you out, and then the table is for the next group. We don't have that. It's just one group of people, and that's it for that night.
And those Kiev dinners are also served family style. So I know I've
yep.
there's one long table, and
yep.
I know I've met a lot of fun people. And by the time you're eating, maybe having some Russian water with them, everyone becomes friends.
That's right. Yeah, we try to do it more family friendly, or family style dining. And if you do go to another restaurant, like I said, it's going to be like that as well. Everybody kind of sits together, and it's the best way to try different kind of foods.
Now you mentioned cabbage and beets as being common ingredients. What other common ingredients are there to Russian food?
Potatoes. So if you go back to our culture, it comes from poor foods, let's just say. So cabbage, beets, and potatoes was always one of the things that you could find. And it was one of the things that people were able to afford. So I think we made the dishes out of those ingredients, whatever we can think of. So that's why pilmeni, which are meat dumplings, also was cheap to make back in the day. Just meat and dough. Same with pierogies, dough and potatoes. So every one of those items that you see, they're not like gourmet items. They're more like a poor man's food ingredients that we kind of created into a menu.
And how about in terms of preparation techniques? If people think Russia, even though it does have seasons, they think of it, especially up north, maybe a little colder. You do more braises, things that are boiled, or do you also do things that are grilled or sauteed?
Right now, if you go to Russia or Ukraine right now, I mean, the culinary has, it's like going to France or Spain. It went from nothing to something. People make out of something like flour and meat, like a nice gourmet dish. But yeah, we don't have anything fried. Like at our business, we don't fry anything. Mostly it's either made in the oven or it's boiled.
And talk a little bit about beverages that might be typical for a Russian or Ukrainian meal. And people automatically think about vodka. But there are other things in Russia besides vodka, right?
Yes. Right now, I mean, alcoholically wise, yes, there's they all drink champagne and wines. But non-alcoholic stuff, we're very famous for compote, which is like an authentic fruit juice that we make, just made out of either strawberries or just berries, made just boiled fruit, basically, and then we chill it. So it's a really nice drink for summertime. But also another famous popular drink over there is kvass, which is fermented black bread.
Fermented black
yeah.
bread?
We what don't,
what
yeah.
does that taste like?
It almost tastes like a flat root beer.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a yeasty,
yeasty
malty
soda mm-hmm. with a little carbonation in it. We don't really make that because it's way too much work. But sometimes we purchase the bottle. It tastes pretty good. I mean, if you get it like when it's just made, it's really, really good. It has a little, because of the fermented bread, it has a little bit of alcohol in it. Mm-hmm. But something that even kids can drink because it's not much in it.
Well, talk to me a little bit about your typical partner in the kitchen. Usually you have someone back there with you.
Oh, that partner.
No, that's your mother, right?
That's my mother,
and
yes.
And you call her Mama?
I call her Mamochka.
Right.
It's like a cute way to say Mama. It's like Mommy in English. She took over. She's the boss now. I am her slave, basically. She is the one who makes everything. She's the one in the kitchen. She makes all the dishes, all the creations, all the recipes. So I don't really have anything to do with the kitchen because two chefs in the kitchen is not a good thing.
Now, are the recipes handed down from families, or they're creations that she's seen over time? Where'd you get those?
It's mixed. Some of the things that she's made for us since we were little. And some of the recipes that she kind of created on her own. There's for our kind of cooking, there's if you look up borscht online, for example, there are 100 different ways to make it. She makes it her way. That's her own recipe. Same with everything else. Everybody kind of tweaks everything, and you could add stuff, you can take some stuff out. So she does her own thing.
I know they'll say with certain like Middle Eastern families, you can judge the quality of the cook by things like their hummus. Can you do that with borscht with Russian people in terms of like, oh, they make the best borscht, they really know what they're doing in the kitchen? Or is it just really a family variance based on what one family might like over another?
Yeah, I guess it depends. Borscht is usually like a really beet-based soup. So if you're not a fan of beets, you're most likely not going to like borscht. But the way she makes it is you can't really tell that there are beets in there. She just uses beets for color, but there's no chunks of beets. If you go to another place and you get a bowl of borscht, you're going to see chunks of beets. And a lot of people who don't like beets, they're not going to like that kind of a texture or the soup. But because she kind of hides the beets and just uses it more for color, people still, even though they don't like beets, they love our borscht. So we've turned non-borscht lovers into fans.
What a tribute.
Yeah.
Now, I know the food at Black Forest Deli is delicious, but I also know that you focus on fresh ingredients and a lot of healthy ingredients. And how do you balance that in terms of what you want to provide in terms of a culinary experience, but also knowing that, hey, this is food that people are putting in their body?
Yeah. So we're just used to that custom. Like when we lived in Ukraine, there is no such thing as you're going food shopping for a week. You buy everything as you need. And that's kind of how I live my life at home. And that's how I do it. We do it at the business too. That, and also we don't have storage space. So that's another problem.
Out of necessity.
Yes. So we kind of have to go every day and buy the fruits and vegetables and everything we need to make our pierogies and stuff like that. But we are huge believers in fresh, local. We buy, you know, a lot of, especially in the season, summertime, we get it from farmers markets. Everything that we need, we use beets and cabbage from certain people that we get from. So yeah, we like to make everything fresh, and that's the way to go in our place. So everything we make is in the morning, and then by the end of the day, you can come. We usually close at 4. By the end of the day, if you come in at 3:30 and we're out of something, it's not because we didn't make it. It's because we just make it. We try to make everything for 24 hours.
Got it. Now, I know you did just start a pierogi business too. You can find Mama's Pierogies outside of Black Forest Deli, or is that the plan?
So, yeah, we've had pierogies on our menu for as long as we've been in business. But lately, because our pierogies have been so popular at our location, as well as winning awards and all that stuff, we were approached by local markets to sell them there. So it kind of works out for both of us in a way where, you know, we close on the earlier side. My customers are able to go to a different place, get some dinner, get our pierogies, shop with that place like Elias or something. And it's a win-win for both, because we're now trying to support two local businesses at the same time.
Right. And just, we have around 30 seconds left. I know social media has been huge for you. Talk a little bit about the impact that's had on terms of letting people know about Black Forest Deli and what you're doing.
Yeah, I love social media. I think if you use it the right way, it brings a lot to your business. And it's a great way for us to tell our customers what we have, what we're doing, what events we're hosting. And it works out great when you know how to use it the right way.
So, Vika, thank you for joining us here at WDIY. And I think to wish you luck in Russian, I can say udashi.
Oh, very nice.
Not too bad, huh?
Да, молодец.
So, udashi to Black Forest Deli.
Спасибо.
And to Mama's Pierogies.
Спасибо.
I'm Mike Dravenstad, and this is The Inside Dish on Lehigh Valley Art Salon.
Attention beer lovers. WDIY's Homebrew Fest is back, featuring an afternoon of beer tasting and music with over 30 handcrafted beers from the Lehigh Valley's best homebrewers. Saturday, July 8th from 2 to 5 p.m. at the Ice House in Bethlehem. Discounted early bird tickets are available now for a limited time. Get your tickets today at WDIY.org. Cheers.
Hello and welcome to The Inside Dish on Lehigh Valley Art Salon, where we explore the culinary arts in and around the greater Lehigh Valley. I'm Mike Dravenstadt, your host for our culinary tour of the region and its amazing food scene. I'm here with Chad Butters from Eight Oaks Craft Distillers in New Tripoli, which is in northern Lehigh County. Chad, welcome to The Inside Dish.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Now, I know you describe Eight Oaks as a farm-to-bottle distillery.
We do.
And what does that mean, and how does it make you different?
Yeah, what that means to us is we grow our own grain. So wheat, rye, corn, barley, all that's non-GMO, raised right on the farm. So we take it from that state into a mill and mill it and then ferment it and distill it. So we're taking it all the way literally from the seed to the glass.
Now, is that more of a philosophy that you want to bring to distilling, or are you looking at it from a flavor profile standpoint?
Both. Yeah, both. So you certainly have control of your inputs that way, and you can dedicate the quality and the flavor that you're looking for through selecting certain varieties. But it's also a mentality that we wanted to bring to it, you know, just as an overall business plan. What we wanted to do was have some place that we could grow stuff from the ground up and that people could come out and take a look at and get to know a little bit.
Now, in terms of the spirits that you make, do you also look at the history of the region and how Absolutely. You want to incorporate things that maybe go back 50, 100, 200, 300 years in this area? Tell me about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the really interesting parts about this particular business is it's a confluence between history and science and agriculture, and where all those meet, you just wrap it in a big bow of fun, and that's distilling, right? So, yeah, the history component of this is really important to me. It's something that I just kind of geek out on a little bit. And one of the things that we have is Applejack, which is a product that's made from apple cider. And it's been made here in this region since at least the 1770s.
Wow.
So it's the authentic original American spirit. So before rye whiskey and bourbon were even born, that's what Americans were drinking, and we're really pleased to be part of trying to, you know, bring that back.
So that'd be one of the common spirits back in the 1700s in this
area. Oh, it
would be
the common spirit in the 1700s, and I think it's been the common spirit here ever since, either legally or illegally, but it's been the common spirit here ever since. Yeah, so we're really pleased to be part of that.
Now, I know wineries will talk about terroir, you know, the effect of climate and soil and all these things. Is there terroir when it comes to spirits?
100%. Yeah, absolutely. Because you're dealing with the same thing, you know. And I think that's one of the things when I look at, for instance, just a glass of whiskey, right? If you look at that glass of whiskey and you think about all the things that came into getting that glass of whiskey to its final destination there, the terroir has a lot to do with that. You know, it's the soil that's been around since the beginning of time and the nutrients that go into it that raise the grain. That then you harvest and dry and use for the actual spirit. So no doubt about it, the environment, the seasonal changes have an impact on final flavor and just the characteristic of the spirit. So I think I find that exciting and fun because each batch is more like a vintage of wine instead of just a batch of vodka, for instance, because every year it's going to have a slight variation. I'm great with that.
Now, our consumers adjusting to that, because I think when they think of spirits, they go to the state store and they get something that's it tastes the same now as it did back in the 1990s.
Yeah,
you know, the different character that you might bring to each year of spirits or each vintage, is that something that people are embracing, or are they a little resistant to that?
Yeah, no, I think they're embracing it overall. I get that question a lot of times from people about how do you make sure that it's consistent. And what I'm after is consistent quality. And quality to me is a smoothness, is a mouthfeel, is an experience with that spirit that's a positive one, right? So it's not necessarily, you know, that it's got to taste exactly the same time over time. Applejack's a great example, again, because each batch is made with different apples just based on the seasonal change. So you do get slight variations, but those variations aren't wild by any measure. You know, there's subtle hints that it's a little bit different batch over batch. Again, the quality is still exceptional.
Now, you mentioned Applejack. Tell us about some of the other spirits that you'll make up at 8 Oaks.
Sure. So vodka, gin, rum. We do a rye whiskey as well. We're going to be releasing our bourbon here in June. So that's coming right up. And we'll also do some other spirits like an aged rum, an aged Applejack, a barrel-rested gin. So there's just a ton of things, of varieties that you can do.
Now, how long have you been distilling with 8 Oaks?
15 months now.
15 months. Now, is it? I imagine you wanted to come out and be creative with a lot of things, but some things take time if they're barrel-aged. How have you been, instilling patience into what you do as well?
Yeah, that is a difficult part of the journey for sure. It's like when we go into work and we see the barrels resting, you know, and just waiting. It's a lot like walking into a living room on Christmas Day, you know, and seeing all the presents that are wrapped.
Except it's every morning over and over again.
But you can't touch them. Yeah, except it's over and over again. So every morning we go in and see these barrels. And sometimes we get to shake them a little by, you know, tapping into them and taking a little sample. So we get to see kind of the direction that they're going, which is important. It's a patient, you know, man's game.
And so how long might some of those spirits age in the barrels?
We'll have some that's a year, two, four, six. I can't wait to have my grandchildren opening barrels, you know, when they're my age and I'm sitting back on the porch just enjoying it.
Is it possible for you to give us a 90-second introduction to the science of distilling, about how you go about distilling?
Yeah. I guess, you know, start the clock and we'll see if we can hit 90 seconds. But,
I'll give you some.
Yeah,
some,
give me some leeway. Yeah, that'll be good. I think, well, essentially what we're doing is we're taking grain, for instance. Let's just start with a grain because otherwise there's a multitude of different inputs you could have. So let's discuss just grain. So a batch of bourbon, for instance. So you would take corn, you raise the corn, you dry the corn and store it. And then you're going to go through a milling process, and you're just going to break that corn down mechanically with a hammer mill, and get that corn down to the consistency of basically a corn flour. And all you're doing is getting it to a point where you can mix it with water. So you're going to do what's called mashing next, which is hot water and introducing the grain and hydrating that grain with the hot water. You mix that, you know, mechanically mix that together over a period of time. Usually 5-6 hours is about what it takes. So you're cooking that corn essentially, and then you're going to take and cool that down and hit certain temperatures. So just like you would if you were baking or cooking a meal, mm-hmm. you're going to put the ingredients together, you're going to put it in an oven at a certain, you know, temperature for a certain length of time, and then you're going to take the meal out and, you know, let it cool and enjoy it. Kind of same process with mashing. We just hit certain temperatures at various temperatures. We have to introduce a little bit of extra additives, which would be something like enzymes. Mm-hmm. The enzymes break down, they essentially take starch and convert it to sugar.
Right.
So that's what we're looking for, is we want a nice sugary substance at the end of that mashing process so that we can introduce yeast.
Which is the starch, the sugar, right?
Yep, the starch uh-huh. turns it into sugar, or the starch does turn into sugar.
Yes.
And then we introduce yeast. The yeast eat the sugar, and there's two byproducts of that, and one of them is ethanol, and one of them is CO2. Mm-hmm. So those are the two byproducts that are happening, and we're interested, obviously, in the ethanol, the alcohol right. portion. So that process begins the fermentation stage, which goes anywhere from 4 to 8 days, depending on what we're fermenting. At the end of that fermentation, you end up with somewhere around a 8 to 10, 12% alcohol by volume, depending on what you're making. And then you're going to do distillation. And distillation is really nothing more than separating components of a whole by their boiling point. So each individual component has its individual boiling point. As you apply heat through distillation, you separate those ingredients or those individual compounds by their boiling point. So by definition, a volatile compound boils over early. So acetone, methanol, those types of things will boil off very early. And then you'll end up getting into the actual ethanol, mm-hmm. and that's where we collect that through a process of condensation, essentially. So the vapor goes over into a final condenser, condenses back into a liquid, and that's what we collect, more than 90 seconds.
Well, it's a complicated process. So the flavor would come from the grains that you use, or any sort of, like, you know, with gin, you have botanicals that you put in sure. there to impart flavor, yes?
Yeah, absolutely. The flavor actually comes from several different places. One's the yeast actually imparts a significant amount of flavor. The input that you use, whether or not you age it, mm-hmm. And finally the process that you use as far as the distillation process and applying appropriate cuts as the distiller makes the selection of the spirit that you're actually collecting.
Now, are there spirits that you're anxious to try that you haven't tried yet that you want to give a shot?
There are actually many of them, yeah. And I think that's one of the pitfalls of this particular industry is being able to focus on what mm-hmm. you can do now. There's so much out there to explore, you know, tequilas and different European spirits that we would really like to get into. It's just a matter of trying to take a methodical approach and do those as you have time to explore those things. Yeah.
Chad, tell me a little bit about the significance of the number 8 in your name.
Sure, yeah. So the number 8 for us and our family, it originated when my grandfather was alive and he was working. He would often work away from his family. And in those days, in the 30s and 40s, he would write letters to stay in touch. Mm-hmm. So he would write letters to his wife, my grandmother, and his son, my father. And at the end of those letters, he would sign it off with a number 8. So the number 8 to him was representative of the 8 letters in I love you. So that's how he communicated that emotion to his family. My dad did exactly the same thing with me as I was growing up. if there were, you know, occasions that he may be away from home, birthday cards or whatever, he would write those back to me, and that number 8 would always be there. I did exactly the same thing as I traveled the world with the military, and now we're using Facebook and text messages and things like that, but that number is always representative of that. So we knew we wanted to include that in the business name. My dad and my grandfather have since passed on, but that's how we kind of keep them close.
So it's a nod to history, but also a nod to family
to
as well.
To family, sure, yeah. And the Oaks, because the oak tree to me is symbolic of strength and nature and longevity. And the oak tree also plays a huge part in the flavoring of whiskeys because everything we age is in brand new white American oak barrels.
Okay. Where can people find your spirits? I mean, certainly you're up in New Tripoli, but right. I think you have distribution outside of that, correct?
We do, sure. So there's several PLCB stores that we're in and continuing to add more on a fairly frequent basis. And really a big focus of ours is farmers markets. That's a great place for us to go and meet our customers face-to-face and be able to talk to them a little bit about the product. So we're in many, many farmers markets from
here. I see you in Allentown every weekend.
Allentown every weekend. And we're down at Reading Terminal Market in Philly on Wednesday, Friday, Saturday. Easton, Emmaus, Wrightstown, several farmers markets around. So you can look at our website. And
given your farm-to-bottle approach, that's a natural place for you to be amid all the other people doing local things, correct?
Yeah, exactly. And I think the same people that you know go to farmers markets to enjoy other locally raised things, whether that's vegetables or dairy products or what have you, they're the same people that want to try our stuff. So it's just a good fit.
Are you seeing the same craft movement in distilling that maybe we've seen in beer and other beverages as well? We have around 30 seconds.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, time will tell, but it seems to me that you're going to see exactly the same kind of growth trend within distilled spirits as you did with the craft beverage or craft beer movement over from the mid-90s to now.
And people are looking for different things, and certainly they can find them at your place.
They are, and they can. One of the things I'm really happy about in the Lehigh Valley is there's an exceptional amount of great quality local products. We're happy to be one of them.
That's great. Chad, thanks for joining us here at WDIY.
Yeah, pleasure.
And best of luck to you and 8 Oaks and to your entire family.
Thanks so much for having us.
I'm Mike Dravenstadt, and this is The Inside Dish on Lehigh Valley Art Salon.
Next up on Lehigh Valley Art Salon, At the Movies, a review of a current film with Paul Willistein of the Press.
Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Men Tell No Tales could be more aptly subtitled Lousy Screenplays Tell No Tales. Therein lies the problem with the fifth sequel in the Pirates of the Caribbean series that stars Johnny Depp as Captain Jack Sparrow. Johnny Depp is the bright spot. He doesn't so much swashbuckle as sashay, speaks with an at times difficult to understand drunken lisp, and rolls his eyes at every ironic aside in the grand manner of a silent movie star. Dead Men Tell No Tales is a mishmash. It's one part zombie movie. Captain Salazar, played by Javier Bardem, captains a ship of undead crew. It's one part chase film. Captain Barbossa, played by Geoffrey Rush, and a British Navy warship want to track Jack Sparrow to his death. It's one part Pirate's Life Quipathon by Jack Sparrow, quote, horology, unquote, he intones, referencing the study of time by Karina Smythe, played by Kea Scolidario. It's one part romance between Karina and Henry, played by Brenton Thwaites, and also between Elizabeth Swann, played by Keira Knightley, and Will Turner, played by Orlando Bloom, in what amounts to cameos by them, and it's one part supernatural thriller. Zombie sharks pursue Jack Sparrow. The Black Pearl is transformed from a ship in a bottle to a life-size seagoing vessel. There's the pursuit of that oddly named Trident of the Poseidon, and there's that ocean trough akin to the parting of the Red Sea. Dead Men Tell No Tales doesn't seem so much a battle of the pirates as a battle of the directors Joachim Rønning and Espen Sandberg and the screenwriter Jeff Nathanson. While the computer-generated imagery is impressive and the effects in 3D, the format seen for this review, are terrific, the Captain Salazar ocean battle flashbacks and the visually very dark Trident of the Poseidon scenes nearly sink the film. At times, though, Dead Men Tell No Tales is indeed silly, spectacular fun, Even so, at one point, one of the characters asks, quote, "This may sound like a peculiar question, but can someone explain to me why I'm here?" Unquote. My sentiments exactly. One can hope for better luck next time, since Pirates of the Caribbean 6 has already been announced. Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Men Tell No Tales is MPAA rated PG for sequences of adventure violence and some suggestive content. Opening June 9 are The Mummy. Alex Kurtzman directs Tom Cruise, Sophia Boutella, Annabelle Wallace, and Russell Crowe in the fantasy horror film about an ancient princess awakened from her crypt with centuries of bad attitude. Megan Levy, Gabriella Cowperthwaite directs Kate Mara, Bradley Whitford, Geraldine James in the biography war drama based on the true story of a Marine corporal whose military combat dog saved many lives in Iraq. I'm Paul Willestein of the Lehigh Valley Press at the movies for WDIY.